Good morning. So last time we talked about some more details of forwarding. We talked about, well, how do we decide whether we need to forward? And we saw sort of our key idea was that we wanted to compare where a value came from with where values that are waiting to be written will be written. And typically this would deal with registers. We'd have the index of the registers. Remember, the register file is kind of like an array of registers. We have an index into that array. We compare those indices to say, oh, this instruction's reading REX while this other instruction is, you know, in the process of writing it but hasn't finished yet. And we use that information to decide to forward a value. We also learned that we have to be a little careful when we're doing these decisions, because sometimes we'll have multiple candidates to forward. We might have a couple of different instructions that are all computing values for REX, and we need to make sure we decide between them correctly. And the way we're going to decide is that one of them is going to have the most recent value, and that's the one we want. We also talked a bit about forwarding paths. So in our textbook, we always forward to the end of the code. And this, I think, is pretty sensible, because the way we can think of it is that we're going to read a value from the register file, and then we're going to fix that value, because sometimes it's wrong. We're just going to do that right away. But we have correct results by also forwarding to other places. And we saw one example where we might actually want to do this, which is that we could forward to the end of execute when the value is only needed in the memory stage. The key thing we have to pay attention to is that when we're doing forwarding, we need to make sure that when we're forwarding, well, the value we're forwarding is actually available. We can't forward a value that hasn't been computed yet, and that the place we're forwarding to is actually a place where we can use the value. We can't, like, forward after the execute stage if the value needs to be used in the execute stage. We can't forward something to be added if we've already done our add operation for the instruction. We instead are going to need to delay that add operation. That's when we have to forward. And a trap that some people run into when they're deciding, oh, we can do some extra forwarding that the textbook didn't do, is that they might want to implement a forwarding path that will physically work, but will make the critical path a lot longer. And the example we gave is you could say, oh, we had this problem where we needed to stall when we had a move from memory to a register followed by like an add using that register. We might say, oh, can't we solve that problem by taking the output of memory and sending it to the adder? Well, you can do that, but it's not going to solve your problem, because it's going to make your cycle time much longer, because basically you're combining the memory and execute stages in one case. You might say, well, that's only one case, but remember, the way we decide our cycle time is the worst case. So if you make one case bad, that's going to make all the instructions slower, even if that case never comes up. And we also talked about, well, you know, combining forwarding and stalling with that in mind. So since we want to avoid making the critical path much longer, you know, sometimes we're going to find out that when the value is available to forward and when we need it, well, if we don't do anything, the value is not available to forward until after we need it. So our solution to that is we're going to use stalling to wait until the value is actually available to forward, then we're going to forward. We're not going to just give up and say, I can't use forwarding for this problem. We're going to use forwarding, but we're going to wait until forwarding works. That's going to be less waiting than we do if we were only using stalling. Some questions about these things we covered last time. Okay, so based on the quiz scores, I'm going to go over the first two quiz questions. So quiz question one and two, we're both dealing with, let's say we have a different pipeline and we're running this set of instructions, what's going to happen? In our first case is a pipeline where we had sort of two memory stages. And our first instruction just executes normally. Our second instruction, it's using the result of the first instruction. That's not a problem, because we can use forwarding to make sure it gets the value of RCX before it needs to add 8 to it in the execute stage. But the instruction after this needs to use the value of RAX in its execute stage, and it can't get that until the end of the memory two stage. We can't forward earlier, because then we'd be sort of combining our memory two and execute stages, That would be a longer critical path. There's no need to wait till later. So we end up wasting two cycles where we can't actually get the value we want, and then we fork. And this ends up, if we said if add is fetched during cycle one, we just count and we figure out that the subtract does its write back in cycle two. Some questions about how I figured this out? Okay. So in the second question, we had execute split into three parts. So first, we needed to get the value of RCX for the 8 plus REX computation. And here, it wasn't so simple that when the value was available is at the end of execute 3. And that means we can't start the execute 1 of the next instruction, which needs to add that to 8, until later. So we need to delay that execute 1 and use forwarding to transfer the value. And it ends up being two cycles of stall. Then, after we've delayed this MRMoveQ instruction by that, we still need to wait until after its memory stage to get the value for the subtracts execute. So that gives us another three cycles of stalling. So we end up having a total of five cycles added on, just waiting for values to be available to forward. Questions? So, everyone. Okay. So, with no questions on that, we move on to the main topic for today, which is going to be about control heist. So, when we finished off last time, we mentioned that we had this problem that, like here, I have a subtract followed by a jump if equal. And to figure out what our program counter should be after, in the cycle after the jump if equal, it seems like we have a problem. That we need to know, is the subtract result going to be zero or not? If it's zero, we want to set our PC to 0xFFFF. Otherwise, we want to set it to the address of the addQ instruction. So the question is, well, how do we deal with this? And, well, earlier we learned that stalling solves all hazards. So we can do it with stalling. So our stalling solution is going to be that we're just going to delay actually going to the next PC for two cycles. So we have two cycles where we're just not doing anything useful, assuming that you know there's one useful cycle of work to do for the jump. If equal, arguably maybe three cycles where we're not doing anything useful. You don't think the jump doesn't really do anything besides set the next PC. But we're going to have to wait, and we have to wait because we need SF and ZF to be updated for the jump if equal to use. And we don't want to use an old version of SF and ZF. And we can draw this in sort of a different way, where let's say this jump is taken, what we're going to end up doing is we're going to have our jump go through the pipeline. And a way we can visualize this is that when the jump gets to the memory stage, we're going to finally figure out what to fetch and fetch it then. And so the way we're going to think of this is that we're going to get the value of ZF in the execute stage, because that's the earliest we can, that it's going to be set correctly. And then we're going to compute what's the address we want to jump to, or not jump to, you know, what's the address to run next. And then we're going to use that information and send it to the fetch stage in the next cycle. So this is sort of the timeline our textbook imagines, you might say. Maybe we could speed this up by like doing this work, combining part of the execute and fetch stage to do this work in one cycle. That's not what our textbook does. Our textbook assumes that we have one cycle to process the condition codes. But it wouldn't be unrealistic to make a processor where you say, we're going to make the fetch a little slower by including that in the fetch. But they decided that they don't want to do that. So that's a separate cycle. But this means that, you know, we have these two sort of wasted cycles for every jump if we're using this design. We don't know what the outcome of the jump is. So questions? So I showed this for conditional jump, which I think is probably the most subtle one, because if you're thinking naively about conditional jump, you might say, oh, we could just use SF and ZF, but you can't use it right away because it's not going to be set correctly, sometimes at least. We also have to do the same thing for return. So in this example, we have a call to this function called empty, which just returns. And our return needs to fetch the place to jump back to from memory, because it's stored on the stack is stored in memory, and we absolutely can't do that fetch earlier in general, because in a case like this, it's not going to be written until after we get to the memory stage. Because the worst case is that we have a call instruction, the call instruction can't write until it gets to its memory stage, so the earliest we can read is our return's memory stage. So this gives us, we don't have a highlight for that, 3 cycles of stalling, just doing nothing. Okay, some questions about our 2 stalling cases here. So as a preview, we're going to make this case better. We're going to improve this somehow. We aren't actually going to do it for this case. This case, if this is what we're going to end up doing, though there are ways of improving this, which we might talk about briefly. So if we're doing this sort of stalling, if we were only doing stalling, we end up with an extra 3 cycles for data dependencies. So, with forwarding, to this is 1 extra cycle, because the only case we had to worry about was the memory to execute case. And we have an extra 3 cycles for every return. We're going to have that with forwarding too. And an extra 2 cycles for every jump. We're going to have this with forwarding. But we're going to have something that's going to make that not always as bad. This is what we're going to end up for our final processor. But with only stalling, we've gotten rid of our first case, mostly, some exception. We're not going to get rid of our second case. In our third case, we're going to talk about something that will partially solve it, but sometimes we'll still have 2 wasted cycles. Okay, so let's do a little exercise with dependencies now that we know about, we think about conditional jumps. So where are our dependencies here? So I'm going to tell me about a dependency. Two instructions here. Yeah.
First add Q is the bit on RBX from
RBQ. Okay, so we need this RBX value needs to be set there. That's a dependency. Others? So the jump not equal, I probably should draw this in a consistent way because we're being consistent. So the jump not equal depends on the flags. Yeah. What else do we have? And let's assume that based on how this is written that the jump not equal is taken. The MRMU queue is dependent on this add queue, okay? Okay, anything else? Yeah. So RCX is dependent, even though it goes across the jump, that's still a dependency. And we could still even need to do forwarding for it potentially. Okay. Other. Okay, so those are our dependencies. Yes. Question? No. So to figure out which are resolved with forwarding, let's assume for now we're doing stalling for the jump. But if not, we'll have something else about that later, which might change our answer. So if we're thinking of our five-stage pipeline, I should probably draw this with enough room. So five-stage pipeline, we're going to say that we hope not to have any stalling, but we're going to see what we have to do. So here, for our first example, this is our load use hazard. So the value we want is not available until after the memory stage. So we're going to need to have a stall happen before we forward it. Then we're going to run our jump. We have to figure out what's going to happen as far as when the next instruction is fetched. And if we had to do stalling, well, the next instruction for the jump is, I should write this out correctly. You know, the jump is not going to decode until the add does its execute. Not that the jump's doing anything in decode, but we'll track the same stages for the jump. And the jump will figure out the result of our condition codes in its execute stage. So we'll have our condition code values passed there. And at this point, next, we will figure out the correct thing to fetch. So if this is what's happening, if we're not figuring out fetching the correct instruction until here, then we will end up not doing the decode until after it's write back, and we won't have any problems. We don't need forwarding, I should say. I should write this out in a way that makes it clearer what's happening, because the execute, after the execute, we figure out what to fetch. So that's at the same time as the write back, W, and we just have the forwarding for the next case. So questions? Some people look confused. So that's assuming we have to stall. Yes? So question, why am I forwarding from, so this is not forwarding. So these dotted green lines here, the first one represents, this is here, this represents ZF and SF. So we're not forwarding, we're just storing values in our flag registers. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, what's going on during the execute stage of the conditional jump? We are looking at SF and ZF and deciding, is the jump taken or not? Okay, so this is the timeline we'd get with stalling. Now, we're going to have a solution where sometimes we're going to avoid waiting to fetch the right instruction after the jump, and instead, we're going to fetch it right away. So the way that's going to look is that instead of fetching it here, we're going to, just right after the jump, we're going to fetch our add and then we're going to fetch our power move. And when that happens, we're going to actually have to forward a value of RCX. And that's sort of going to be our main topic for today. But we have these sort of, with stalling, we end up waiting all this time. Without stalling, we could hope to fetch the instruction earlier. The question is, so how can we do that, right? We know we can't actually compute that this add instruction is what runs next. We don't know that until we get to the jump's execute stage, and we actually have to do work in the execute stage to figure out that this is how we interpret the condition codes, that's what the result is. So how can we do that earlier? And the answer is going to be that we're going to make a guess. That every time we have a jump instruction, rather than always doing this solution of just giving up on figuring out the next instruction until we actually know the answer, we're going to make a guess. And why can we make a guess? Because there's two possible guesses. So if we make a random guess, we're probably going to be right half the time. And this means that we're only going to actually stall half the time. So we're only going to actually have the effect of doing this half the time, because half the time we're going to guess correctly. So this is sometimes called speculation or branch prediction. Branch, because a branch is what the name we give to a conditional jump instruction. And when we're right, we're 2 cycles faster. And when we're wrong, well, that's going to be a little more complicated. But when we're wrong, we're going to make it so we just forget about the things we guessed. We're going to undo them and do the same thing we would have done if stalling. So if we were stalling, we wait 2 cycles, then we fetch the right thing. So we're going to do the same sort of thing when we guess wrong, but when we guess right, we just already fetched the right thing. We're all done. We're not going to do nothing. So basically, we're always going to try to do what I have in pink here, just executing the instructions right away. And that's going to involve, like, for example, in this case, we forward the value from add queue there. So that's what we're going to try to do. And sometimes it's not going to work out, and we're going to end up doing what's in green. So the question is, how can we get away with this because of the thing I said under wrong? We're going to forget about the instructions we've started in some case. That sounds complicated. And the general version of that actually is pretty complicated. So the real processors do this in cases where that part of forget about the things we guessed is pretty complicated. But for our processor, it's actually pretty simple. And the reason why is if we think about what things actually change when we're running an instruction. So we know like the pipeline registers change and the program counter changes, but for the most part, our instructions don't change anything until we get to the execute stage. So we have 2 cycles, which not coincidentally is the number of cycles we need to make our decision, where the instructions don't change anything outside of pipeline registers and the PC. And this means that to undo an instruction that hasn't gotten past decode, all we need to do is change the values in the pipeline registers. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to run the instruction up to decode. And at that point, we're going to figure out, can I let it keep going just normally? In which case, it's easier than implementing the jump with stalling. Otherwise, I'm going to undo the changes it would make to the pipeline registers. And that's not even going to be really changing the pipeline registers. It's just going to block it from sending things to the pipeline registers, basically. So the timeline we'd end up with is going to look something like this when we speculate right. We're going to guess that we run, in this case, this add an arrow remove queue. And they're just going to keep going through the pipeline normally. It's going to be as if we do what the jump was an unconditional jump, right? That's just how it's going to work when we're right. There's not going to be any waiting. Is this going to be like an unconditional jump? No stalling, no waiting whatsoever. When we're wrong, we're going to have to squash, that's the actual jargon term that is used in the field, these wrong guesses. So we're going to have to take these instructions that made it to fetch and decode and keep them from moving on in the pipeline. And what we want to happen in the next stage is we want to have nothing in those pipeline stages. So nothing is a no-op. We have an instruction for that. So we're going to replace the values these instructions would put in their pipeline registers with a no-op. And we'll talk about what the sort of actual HCL code for that looks like later today. And then we're going to have some extra logic to, instead of fetching the instruction after the R remove queue, to say, wait a moment, I need to fetch the thing the jump wants to go to, and that's just going to be a mux. We're going to have a mux which decides, oh, don't use the value from the instruction that is we guessed, use the value from the jump. That the jump just figured out in its execute stage. So questions about this timeline for our conditional jumps with this guessing idea? Okay. And so one thing we haven't answered is, how do we guess? What guess are we going to make? And the guess that our textbook makes and that we're going to make is that we're going to guess that the conditional jumps will always go to their label. That they always are what we call taken jumps. This is the choice our textbook makes. And, well, could we do better? Yes. But if we're just making a choice which is assume it always goes to the label or doesn't, this is the best choice empirically. That if we look at real programs, because programs have loops, and loops usually go back to the top of the loop, guessing that jumps are taken is correct more than half the time. So we're just making the bet, we're making a choice that to assume that they're always taken, because that's the best choices of assuming they're always something. But real processors make some more sophisticated guesses, which we might talk about briefly later. So with that strategy in mind, here's sort of the timings we expect with our processor. That our, with our prediction strategy, our guessing, that a non-taken conditional jump takes 3 cycles, a taken one takes 1 cycle, which previously took 3 with stalling, a return, we haven't done anything about yet, so that still takes 4, and every other instruction takes about 1. I say about 1 because we have that memory to execute problem where we'll take 2, but that's pretty uncommon, we're hoping. And I'm saying, let's say that I run a program on our two processors. We have our processor with stalling and with this branch prediction idea. And my instructions are 3% non-taken conditional jumps, 5% taken conditional jumps, 1% returns, and 91% other stuff. My question is, how much faster am I because I'm doing this prediction strategy, this guessing where the jumps go? I'm just guessing that they're going to be taken. Yes, question? So the question is, the conditional jump target is the same as the actual next address. Wouldn't this be a case where we make things slower by trying to correct what was actually correct things when we don't need to? And the answer is yes. But generally, processors don't worry about this case just because our assumption is that, you know, it's not worth adding the hardware to check for it when we can just tell compiler writers and assembly writers not to do that because it's going to be slow. that answer your question? So the question is, how much faster is our prediction processor than our stalling processor? So anyone want to tell me, how would you get started on this problem? What's a good first step? Yes?
You just would compute the average number of cycles per instruction for the first clock and the average number of cycles per instruction for the second clock.
Okay, so your idea is that we want to compute the average number of cycles per instruction. So that's sort of the quantity we're going to actually compute to compare. So how can we measure the average number of cycles per instruction? And we sort of think about that. We say, okay, so we have this sort of weighted value, that if we have 100 instructions, 91 of them in our prediction processor take one cycle, one of them takes four cycles, five of them takes five cycles, so we can add up sort of the total time, do our standard average computation, and divide by the number of things we have, which was, in my sort of hypothetical, 100. Is that questions on that procedure? So what I end up with is this sort of weighted average computation where I say, okay, 3% of the time we need three cycles, plus 5% of the time we need one cycles, plus 4% of the time we need, 1% of the time we need four cycles, and 91% of the time we need one cycle. So I add those together to get my sort of average number of cycles per instruction. And the way we can look at what I'm doing is I'm saying, oh, if I have 100 instructions, three of them need three cycles, five of them need one cycle, and so on. I'm computing the average time for each of those 100 instructions. And I get that this needs 1.09 cycles per instruction. That's the average number of cycles we need. So if we remember sort of when we introduced pipelining, what we were hoping for is that we ran one instruction a cycle. It turns out we can't do that. We're not quite there. But we can get pretty close with these relatively realistic numbers. And with stalling, you know, the only difference is how much time our taken conditional jumps are. And it might seem like, well, that should have a really tiny impact because those are 5% of our instructions. And arguably, it's a tiny impact. We get 1.19, which is about 10% faster. But note that because the difference between implementing this prediction strategy and not was we took two extra cycles for each of those instructions, that we had a 10% impact even though it was 5% of our instructions. Okay. Questions? Okay. So, now that we know about doing our prediction, let's do a more worked out example of our sort of pipeline dependency. So let's assume here that we're doing prediction, which predicts things as taken. So that means that this jump here is going to be mispredicted, meaning that we're going to fetch things after this jump that aren't actually the right guess. So this is our bad case. Who'd like some more tap? Okay, so let's, so I sort of started this out. We know we're gonna fetch, go through all our stages for each of these instructions. So let's get started out. And I guess the first thing to say is that I told you the just stuff is risk predicted. We're gonna guess, because our policy that we've decided on is that we assume the jump is gonna go to foo. Doesn't in this case. So that means that the first normal thing that's gonna happen is we're gonna fetch two instructions starting at foo after the jump, which is gonna be our guess. And in this case, that guess is wrong. If our guess was right, those two instructions would be the subtract and the call. But they are. We guessed wrong, but we don't know it yet. As of cycle three, we don't know it. So we're just moving on, assuming our guess is right. And in cycle three is when we're figuring out our guess is wrong. Because we'll have received the value of SF and ZF, and now we're processing it for a jump instruction. And at this point, we compute, oh, wait a moment, the instruction I want to run is instruction 3, not 2C. Or not 2B. That was the instruction I wanted to get to. So we're going to do two different things. So one thing we're going to do is we're going to make instructions 2B and 2C go away. We're going to turn them into no-ops. That is, we're going to squash them, is the term. Get rid of them. So we're going to have something going through the executed memory stages, memory write-back stages, but that's going to be a no-op instead of these instructions we fetch because we don't want them to do anything. We're also going to somehow tell our processor to fetch something else. In this case, instruction 3, instead of whatever 2D would be. Questions? How I got where I got so far? Okay. So then we can say, oh, okay, we have our instruction, our add and our subtract. We have a dependency here. We also had a dependency on the flags, which we already took care of. We have a dependency there where we need to read from R9 that the add wrote to. And normally when we see like these instructions just a little apart, we expect there to be forwarding. But if we look at how things worked out, well, the value of R9 is written here, and we want to do the read here, we're fine. We don't actually need to do anything special to handle that because the jump delayed us so much. Now, if our subtract instruction was, you know, this one, then, well, we would have to do for that. Or I should draw the one that makes sense. We would have to do forwarding to the end of the code for that, for example, if that was our subtract instruction. Or that is another instruction that uses R9. But that's not what we ended up with because we didn't guess to go to the subtract instruction. Some questions so far? Yes?
If foo was more than like 2 lines of instruction, could it still only stop after the first 2 cycles of foo has been?
The question is, if there's more than 2 instructions at foo, do we still only do 2? Yes. Because the number of, so in fact, there's more stuff that could run. Because when we actually move on to the next instruction, is determined by when we have this blue line here where we can pass the correct thing to fetch. So that's what determines when we stop guessing things, not how much stuff there is where we're guessing. Does that answer your question? And I guess to give another example of a case that might be confusing with this is that if we say had jump, like a jump to skip, and we had like two instructions, like, and we only skipped over one, we're still going to undo two instructions, even though one of them is correct. Because we're not going to check for that sort of special case. Does that answer your question? Mentioning this because this confuses people too. People were going to say, oh, but we actually want to fetch the instruction on skip because we get to it just naturally. In this case where we have a, not a conditional, I should have a conditional jump, like we have a jump to skip, people want to say, oh, you know, if we're guessing wrong, we're going to fetch the subtracts, or rather than the add, but that doesn't, we don't get to take advantage of the fact that there's some overlap between our right and wrong guesses. We have to just go back to the beginning because, well, the instructions, we do have, need to run the instructions in order. Okay, so getting back to where we are here. So we didn't guess correctly, so we end up having the value pass through registers, and we just move on here. And we can say, okay, we have this R9 value is going to be used by that push, so we need to forward that because it's not going to be written in time because it's written at the end of cycle 8. And it's trying to be read during cycle 7, so we need forwarding to fix that. So we do that. There's one other piece of forwarding I need here. Someone tell me what it is. Yeah. So RSP between call and push? Exactly. So call produces a new RSP. We don't write RSP in the instruction, but we know it modifies RSP, and push reads RSP. Also writes it, but importantly reads it. And normally the value of RSP wouldn't be written until there. That's not early enough, so we also need to forward RSP. Which fortunately we can do after execute because that's where it's computed. So questions? A solution here. Okay, so let's do the same exercise, but this time, I thought I had hidden that. Well, I guess we'll be going through it this way. So let's say we had a pipeline where we had E1 and E2. Instead of, you know, execute split in half. How does this change things? So if we think of how our jump works, well, now we can't compute the value of SF and ZF until E2. So we need the result of the arithmetic. We're going to assume our jump can do the computation in one cycle still for converting the flags into the actual address to fetch. So we end up having three cycles of misprediction. So something that's notable about this prediction idea is that when we make our pipeline longer, this gets worse, a lot worse. And that's something that's true with stalling in general, but sort of all our strategies for handling hazards are cases where adding stages to our pipeline makes things worse. Which was unfortunate because we want to have more stages in our pipeline to decrease our cycle time to make things better. We have this sort of problem with that where that doesn't work out. And in this case, we also have a cycle of stalling to get the stack pointer value. One reason why it's important to remember, oh, there's a stack pointer passed, because, well, it matters. We need to wait for it to be computed. So the call is subtracting from the stack pointer. We need to wait for that subtraction to complete for the push to have the value after the subtraction. So questions on this timeline here? I So where I have marked our forwarding, so we have our computed thing to fetch from after we have a cycle to look at the condition codes. And I said, okay, for my push instruction, now normally I'd like to read the values here, but I said, well, I can read the subtract value, I can't read the calls value for RSP, so I need to wait a cycle, and then I fetch, got the things from both of them. Okay, so we sort of talked about the mechanics of what things look like with this branch prediction. And with stalling in general, we saw stalling for return, we saw what it would look like if we were stalling for conditional jump. And we also mentioned, we did stalling sometimes just to handle going from memory to execute, but we haven't really talked about implementing that. So we're going to talk about what do we do with our pipeline registers to implement this functionality. And one thing we need to do is sometimes we need to stall. We need to keep the same instruction and decode, for example. So how do we do that? And if we think of the fetch to decode registers to keep the same instruction and decode, we want to send back the same value we're getting out of the fetch to decode registers back into them. So the way we can do this is we can have a mux where we decide either we use the values from the thing we just fetched, or we use the values that are currently not going out of the decode register. So this is a way we can implement stalling. We might have similar logic on other pipeline registers and on the PC, where we decide I'm going to keep the current PC because we can't move on yet, or go to the next one, the PC plus X. So this is the sort of logic we have on our pipeline registers and our PC to say, okay, sometimes I want to stay in the same place. We also learned that we need to sometimes insert a do-nothing operation, a pipeline bubble. So we saw this when we did stalling. We needed to say, well, if I'm not going on from decode, the execute stage needs to know to do nothing next cycle. And so a way we can do that is we can have another mux where we sometimes decide to send a value that does nothing. So like register number 15, we learned, basically says not to write anywhere. We could send that on instead of a normal value. And we call this a pipeline bubble, because this is what we send through the pipeline when we just want to send air. So you could absolutely implement these muxes by hand in HCL, and this would be a valid way of implementing all these sort of stalling and prediction logic that we're going to need. But HCLRS has these muxes built into every single register bank. So when you define a bank of registers, AB, there's a signal called stall B and a signal called bubble B that are already implemented, which are versions of these muxes. So stall B is a version of this mux. So that's built in, and stall B is the control signal for that. So if you set it to 1, it's going to select that keep the same value path. Another way we can look at this is that this is a write disable signal for the registers. There's also a bubble signal, which is a version of this. But you might say, how does it know what the value for no op is? And the answer is it assumes your default values are the value for no op. And that makes sense because when our processors are starting, we don't want the write back stage to write a random value. We want it to do nothing. So probably your default values in your register banks are no op values. And the bubble signal will use it. Another way you could look at this is that this is a reset signal. So these are what we're going to use to implement our stalling logic and implement that squashing that we needed for a branch prediction. We're going to use these signals, and assuming you set your default values to actually correspond to a no-op, this will be all you need to do it. You won't need to actually write out these muxes by hand. So questions, sort of on the idea of these stall and bubble signals?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've told you what these signals do. So let's figure out what that means in this example, because my recollection from past semesters is that usually people don't actually know how that works. So remember, stall is keep the old value, or you can think of it as write disable. And bubble is store the default value, we're going to think of it as reset. And I'll start off by telling what happens in the first case. So in the first case here, cycle zero, they're both false. So we're not doing either of those things. So we're doing what the register normally does. What will the register normally do? So the first case, they're both zero, so they're both not selected. So we're just doing what normally a register would do. So what does normally a register do with its input? Anyone? No volunteers. So normally we have a register. We have its input, which in this case is A underscore value, which becomes B underscore value in the next cycle. So normally we're going to copy our input to our output. So that's the normal operation. So these stall and bubble signals are going to modify that normal operation, but the default is always we copy the input to the output. Who would like some more time? Don't see anyone. So let's start with cycle two. So let's say, what would normally be the value during cycle two? Time two, I should say. If we didn't have these stellar bubble signals, what would be the value of B value during time two? Yeah. It would be 2, and that's just because we'd be copying a value. Okay. So in this case, while we're setting it to 2, and that's when these signals take effect, we have stall as 1 and bubble as 0. So what's that going to mean our value during cycle 2 is? So during cycle 1, we're setting it to 2, but we also have stall as 1 and bubble as 0. So what does that mean our actual value during the next cycle is? Yeah, 1. So because we're disabling that write, so we end up with 1. So note that these signals sort of take effect, they modify the write we're doing now. So they don't change the value that's coming out this cycle, because it's too late. They change the value we get later, the next cycle. Okay, so in this case, sort of we block this write, and we just kept the old value. Okay. However, in time three, during time three, we have, so at time two, before cycle time two, three, we have none of these set, so what's going to happen? What's our value, B value going to be at time three? Yeah. 3. So that if we didn't have any stellar bubble signals, that's just what we got normally. So the write's going to happen normally because we didn't do anything to modify it. Okay, how about time 4? What's it going to be at time 4? Yeah. The default value, which is OXFF, yes. And that's because We modified this right with the bubble being set to 1. So bubble means use the default value, which we hope would be in our processor for NOAA. And during time 5, this is normal. Okay. Time 6. Easy one. I guess I should not get any of it. During time 6, it's also normal. Remember, we want to look at the time we're doing the write beforehand. It's still normal there. During time 7, well, when we're doing the write for time 7, we have stall. So we're not going to change the values there. It's a write disable. So we end up with 0x6. And during time 7, the write is still disabled. So we're still not going to change the value that's there. So it's still 6. Because remember, stall means keep the current value. It doesn't mean go back a cycle. It means keep the current value. So questions on figuring this out, the operation of these sort of built-in muxes? Okay. So we know what these muxes do. Now my question is, what do we set them to in our actual processor? So let's say I'm running instructions E, D, C, B, and A in our pipeline, and during the next cycle, I want to keep E in fetch, so I'm going to set my PC to keep it the same. And we're not going to ask about that, but something like stalling. And I also want to not send a not to decode. So I don't want, since I don't want E to advance, I don't want to duplicate it, so I'm going to send a not to decode. I want to get rid of instruction D and have C stay in execute. I don't want anything to be in memory, so I want to knock in memory. I want B to advance for memory to write back normally. So question is, what do we use stall, bubble, or normal for pipeline registers? Then we have sort of 4 sets of pipeline registers represented here plus the PC. And the way this works, we're asking what these signals should be set to during time 1, because that's what determines what's written to be read in time 2. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so I'll start with our first set, from fetch to decode. So normally, what would happen, if we set, so that this is this arrow here. Normally, what would happen is we read the value from fetch and output it to decode. That would be the normal case. If we did that, we'd end up with instruction E, moving from fetch to decode. That's not what we want. What we want instead is we want to end up with a no-op in decode. And the way we do that is we use our reset signal. We want to have the default values instead of the values from fetch right now, instead of instruction E. We also don't want to keep the same instruction in the code, because currently we're outputting during time one, the output is instruction D. We don't want that again either. So we're going to end up choosing bubble. For the code to execute, if we did the normal thing, we'd end up passing instruction D through from the code to execute. Instead, we want to keep instruction C, which is currently what's there. So that's going to be stalling. We want to have the same thing being output that's output now. Because if we think of above here, we got instruction C coming in. We want to have that be the same. So we're going to use stall. From execute to memory, this is a repeat of our fetch to decode case, that normally we pass instruction C through. In this case, we don't want to do that, presumably because we don't want two copies of instruction C. So we're going to end up using bubble to replace it with our default, which is not for memory to write back. You want to pass instruction B through. That's normally what would happen. If we did nothing, it would go to the next stage. So this is normal. So we have worked out version here. So questions on how I figure that out? Yes?
Why is the first one an asterisk?
We're going to make RPC logic probably is not going to use these stellar bubble signals, or might not use them in the conventional way. So we'll talk about that separately. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So here, let's do, is this, no, yes, this one. We'll just have our PC logic, we'll just not ignore for now. So how about fetch to decode? Who thinks we should have stall? Normal? Bubble? No clue? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on normal. Decode to execute. Who thinks we should have stall? Normal? Bubble? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on stall. Execute to memory. Who thinks we should have stall? Normal? Bubble? Okay. And our memory to write back should be normal. Okay, so pretty comfortable on this. So let's talk about applying this to actually implementing stalling and prediction. So this is the stall and bubble is how we're going to handle updating our pipeline registers. So in a stall, we need to repeat the same value, so that's our stall signal. And we also need to make the next stages not do anything, not run the current instruction. So that's our null signal. So I think our textbook named these signals poorly, because stalling the pipeline involves using the stall and bubble signals together. So why is that the case? Well, because we need to insert a NOP to replace the thing that would normally go to execute. So we usually have written this out in our pipeline diagrams, but if we think of time three here, something needs to be happening in the execute stage, so we need to insert some dummy work there to keep it busy. And we need to do that because our subtract stayed in the decode stage. So to implement this, we're going to have to stall the fetch to decode registers, so that's stall D. We're going to have some logic to fetch the same instruction again. So that's either stall F or something extra on your program counter selection box. And we're going to have to bubble E. Oh, we have that. And we're going to have to bubble E to insert an op, because if we don't do that, the subtract's going to go from the code to execute too. We don't want that. So actually implementing the stall involves both setting the stall signals in pipeline registers and setting the bubble signal to make sure we don't accidentally duplicate our subtract instructions. We don't set bubble E here. Instead of having the insert and not, we're going to have another copy of that subtract, which is probably going to give us some wrong answers. So questions? What this logic looks like. So we have our logic to actually keep the instructions back with stall, and bubble to insert an op to replace the instruction that is not moving on in the pipeline. So as for our jumps, when we have the mispredicted case, we're going to implement this with the bubble signal. So what's going to happen is our instruction that normally would move on from decode to execute, fetch to decode, they're going to replace with the NOP. That's just exactly our bubble signal. So our jump case is going to be handled by just setting bubble in this time. So this here, this is going to be bubble underscore D or underscore E as it goes to the execute stage. This one is going to be bubble underscore D because it goes to the decode stage, because that's making in the next cycle we have a NOP and execute and decode. So setting bubble E says put a NOP and execute next cycle. Setting bubble D says put a NOP and decode next cycle. So that's how we're going to implement that squashing. And because the instructions we know haven't actually modified anything else besides the pipeline registers in the PC, that's going to be enough to implement our squashing. That's all we need to do. And another way we can visualize this is what's going to be happening is we're going to be fetching our incorrect instructions, and we're going to set our bubble signals so they don't move on in our pipeline. And also, we're going to do something very special about how we choose the next program counter value. We're not going to actually take it from our move queue. We're going to take it from that jump. So, questions? This logic looks like. Okay. And note that we told you that these bubble install signals, they're about when we're writing the register values. So while the jump is in the execute stage, we're going to set these bubble signals. So the code we might look have for this might look something like this. We're going to see, are we running a conditional jump's execute stage? So I'm looking at EI code for execute version of the I code. And did we just learn that it's not actually taken? And if so, that's a misprediction. And in that case, this is one of the cases in which we're going to set the bubble signals for D and E. So in the next cycle, we have a no-op in decode and execute. So note that we're preparing for the next cycle by doing this. So questions on how I came up with this logic? And we're going to have something similar for return, where return, what we want to do is we want to stall. And for stalling, there's two parts. One thing is that we're going to need to, you know, fetch some nonsense. But the biggest thing is we need to make sure that the decode executed memory stages don't do anything. How are we going to do that? We're going to send NOPs down the pipeline while we're waiting. So what we want to happen is that there's nothing going down the pipeline while the return's happening. And how can we do that? We can use the bubble signal to send nothing to the code. So if we just set the bubble signal, that will send nothing. We don't need to do anything else because it will just go down the pipeline naturally. We don't need to actually deal with execute memory writeback because we just have them run normally. Well, nothing goes from decode to execute. Perfectly fine. So how can we implement this logic? How can we figure out when we need to bubble? It seems like, oh, I need to remember if I fetched a return a couple cycles ago. How can I know that? Well, the trick is that the return is going from fetch to decode to execute to memory to write back, and we can look at that. So probably the way we'd implement this is I'd say, is there a return in decode or execute or memory? If so, I want to have in the next cycle a no op in decode. I don't want to actually fetch anything useful, use anything I fetched. Some questions on this logic here? Okay. So I guess I'm out of time. So next time we'll talk about, you know, we talked about controlling our pipeline stalls and bubbles. Next time we'll talk about how we set the program counter and what that logic looks like.